Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
We'll start on this Friday with the week that was. We'll move briskly on to Valentine's Day as a commodity story. And then we'll finish up with a not-your-average cab ride in New York City. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Friday, the 14th of February. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. And I don't know, maybe it's just me, but it kind of feels like it's been a long, long week out there. So let's just get it behind us, shall we? We'll get going today with our weekly wrap of the 5 days gone by. Neela Richardson is in Washington. She is from Bloomberg Government. Cardiff Garcia is in New York. He is with the blog FT Alphaville. Hey, you guys.
Hey, Kai.
All right, so Neela, I don't mind telling you that I owe a bunch of people around here a bunch of beer because I bet them, and this is actually in emails somewhere, that Congress would not fix the debt limit until it really had to, like the end of the month. And yet, they made a deal. They got out of town. How did that happen?
Man, I would be buying people beers, too, if it makes you feel better. You know what? I think Congress is getting smarter.
You think?
I mean, they passed a budget, and they raised the debt ceiling, and they raised it to a date in March 2015 where the government expects to start collecting a lot of taxes because of the April 15th tax date. That pushes another debt ceiling date until mid of 2015. That's a smart move.
Cardiff, does this presage smarter things from the Congress, do you think, economically?
I don't know. I think this is one of those situations where, amazingly enough, the politically smart thing to do also happened to be the right thing to do, coincidentally. And think about what happened here. Something that normally makes Congress more dysfunctional, which is attaching conditions to raising the debt ceiling, in this case was itself dysfunctional. It didn't work. And the end result was that Congress was functional. So I always breathe a sigh of relief when this happens. But this was sort of a weird backwards channel way of doing it. So I'm not going to say that these showdowns are over. But, hey, let's be happy for it, right?
They both Or Cardiff a beer.
Well, that's right. That totally made my head spin, man. All right. We will move on now to Janet Yellen. She made her first appearance, Dr. Yellen did, in front of Congress as the chair of the Federal Reserve. Neela, first of all, just on style points, her performance, what'd you think?
You know, I thought she was a real economist talking about a real economy. Yeah. She didn't seem scripted to me. She is a labor economist, and it was apparent that she did care about the unemployment picture. There were some prizes for her, and she wasn't afraid to say where she was surprised, but she was also optimistic, and I think the markets liked her.
Cardiff, what do you think?
You know, I thought stylistically she was great and much more confident, for instance, than Ben Bernanke was when he first started his term. That said, you know, she didn't tip her hand that much. She actually said at one point, or many times actually, that there would be continuity between the Bernanke regime and her regime. But she also, as Neela said, really did emphasize that she considers attacking unemployment to be just as big a deal as keeping inflation tight. So I think it's going to be really interesting to see how she does in her first meeting. But I think as openers go, this was pretty great.
Neela, about that first meeting, we're not thinking anything different, right? It's going to be steady as she goes, stay the course?
You know what? I think she has a few surprises in store.
No way. Really? Do you?
Ben Bernanke was
radical
by circumstance.
Because you know I'm a betting man. No, I'm not.
Yeah. Her predecessor was radical because he had to be. These were really telling times. Yeah. Janet Yellen may be radical because she chooses to be, because she sees some problems that she really wants to focus on. And then she has this whole new dynamic in the Dodd-Frank regulation that she'll have to enforce for the first time. So we could get some surprises here.
Huh. Interesting. All right. Last thing, Cardiff, the weather. You guys are hip deep in snow, New York. I think there's another storm coming, by the way.
Yeah.
As the numbers for this quarter and this month start rolling out, are we going to see it? Are we going to see the weather in the numbers?
I think it's possible. This is actually something that we don't know a lot about. We only know the evidence that is very suggestive, not necessarily proved. I think the weather's almost certainly going to play a role. To the extent that it does, it'll probably be transitory. It'll just be a temporary thing. But the problem is that so far the numbers we've got haven't been great, and they've been showing up across a wide variety of industries and economic sectors. So I think there's a good reason to worry that the slowdown is actually more broad-based than just down to the weather.
You think?
I think so,
I hope
too.
Not.
I have to agree with that.
No, Neela, go ahead. You get the last word. You actually think so?
Yeah, I don't think I'm too much of an economist to believe that the government isn't smart enough to adjust for seasonal factors. We've had winters for as long as I can remember, and they do this on a regular basis. I think a lot of this is economic slowdown because it is so broad-based.
Neela Richardson, Bloomberg Government in Washington. Cardiff Garcia, the blog at FT Alphaville. He was in New York. Thanks, you guys.
Thanks, Kat.
All right, have a good weekend. On Wall Street today, I know, but I'm not telling. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. President Obama's up in California's Central Valley today near Fresno talking about water. He's promised to help farmers deal with the drought that we're having here. Short of actually making it rain, though, there's not a whole lot the federal government can do right now. But what the White House is promising is money, some for disaster relief in the short term. But the big ticket item is a $1 billion fund for something called climate resilience. Marketplace's David Weinberg explains.
When floods devastated much of northern Colorado this past fall, several wastewater treatment plants were closed. Just how quickly they were able to get back online is a perfect example of climate resilience. It's a community's ability to recover from a natural disaster.
Drought in California, hurricanes on the eastern seaboard, wildfires in the Rocky Mountain region.
All of these disasters will intensify in the future, says Elizabeth Albright, an assistant professor of environmental policy at Duke. The president's proposed climate resilience fund would provide money to help regions bounce back quicker from disasters, and it would fund research.
I think one of the most important things we can do is try to get a better understanding of the magnitude of floods, the magnitude of hurricanes, the magnitude of droughts that we might face.
Glenn McDonald is the director of the Institute of Environment and Sustainability at UCLA. He says one of the keys to creating resilience is being able to accurately predict just how bad a disaster will be. For example, scientists are coming up with new ways to study aquifers, natural underground reservoirs, to better predict the severity of future droughts.
Where we can actually measure the loss of groundwater through satellite.
Dr. Juliet Christian-Smith is with the Union of Concerned Scientists. She says that using satellites, researchers looked at the Ogallala Aquifer in the Midwest. They found that the depletion of the aquifer is changing the gravitational pull of the Earth.
Because we're extracting groundwater at such a great rate.
In addition to research and disaster preparedness, the proposed $1 billion would also fund new technologies to build more climate-resilient infrastructure. I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace.
Pandora, the music streaming service, is gearing up a new advertising algorithm. It'll let political campaigns and parties advertise to Pandora listeners based on the music that those listeners like. At the heart of that service, of course, is the assumption that a person's musical taste can help predict the way they'll vote. So, science, nonsense, or just a really good business gimmick? Marketplace's Noel King has that story.
Pandora is free for most of its millions of users, so ad revenue is crucial. Laura Martin is a senior media analyst for Needham & Company.
About 80% of Pandora's total revenue is advertising, and they generated about $600 million of revenue in 2013.
From all kinds of ads, including political ads. During the last presidential election, Pandora could tell advertisers two things, your zip code and how people in your zip code vote. Now Pandora is using more data, says Heidi Browning, a Pandora spokesperson.
We look at the variety of music that they listen to and then come up with the data science behind that to weight whether they're more likely to be a Democrat or a Republican.
Independent researchers also see a correlation. Brian Whitman is CTO of the Echo Nest, a music intelligence platform. Back in 2012, he tracked what people listened to and found...
We're able to predict with really high accuracy, you know, who they vote for.
Fans of Rihanna and Lady Gaga likely to be Democrat. Kenny Chesney and Reba McEntire fans, Republican. Republicans, it turns out, also seem to love...
Pink Floyd. That actually surprised me, being a fan of that band.
Whitman also tracked artists that weren't good predictors. They appealed to both Republicans and Democrats. Everybody loves the Beatles and the Stones. But how about this one? Six bands out of the top 10 that drew fans from across the political spectrum were metal. Marilyn Manson, Alice in Chains, and Pantera speak to us, regardless of political persuasion. I'm Noelle King for Marketplace.
All right, here we are, Valentine's Day. You've got, what, a couple hours left probably to pick up something on the way home. And therein actually lies the rub, because a lot of people, most, I'd venture, shop for the objects of their affections on Valentine's Day. So this is a big day for retail. It can be a tough one for your wallet, too, you being short on time and all. But if you can shop around, you can limit the damage, because some Valentine's classics are cheaper this year. Some, but not all, as Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports.
It's Valentine's Day, and obviously we have to start with roses. Jan Ohms has owned Roses and Blooms in Midtown Manhattan for more than 20 years. He takes me to the cooler to see some roses that have just arrived from Ecuador.
They're still in the boxes, but they just came in.
We're looking at about 12,000 roses here.
All told, Ohms expects to sell around 25,000 roses this Valentine's Day. He says there is a Valentine's Day markup, because to get all those roses, shops like his have to contract out entire farms in Central and South America. And the growers charge a premium for the risk of dedicating their entire farms to roses that must be ready just in time for the critical week. In the end, a dozen roses from Roses and Blooms will set you back between $28 and $70.
Overall, the price has been going down a little bit. The bad economy has been hurting the flower business pretty hard.
Meanwhile, pricing competition has gotten fiercer, says Hester Jun, a research analyst with IBISWorld.
Flower prices overall have been declining over the past decade, and that's really with the emergence of online retailers. Price-based competition is more severe.
And flowers aren't the only Valentine's Day essential that's gotten cheaper.
Champagne sales globally have declined since 2007.
Ross Colbert is a global beverage strategist at Rabobank. He says demand for champagne has suffered as cheaper bubbly wines like Prosecco and Spumante have gained popularity.
Pricing today on champagne is probably as low as it's going to go. There's a lot of good value out there.
And you'll need those champagne savings to afford the chocolates this year. New York-based chocolatier Jacques Torres says prices have plumped up a lot lately. That's mostly because of a price increase for chocolate's main raw material.
The price of cocoa rise significantly.
Up more than 25% from last year. That's partly because of skyrocketing demand from new markets like China and India, and partly because of fancier tastes at home.
Dark chocolate sell more and more, and higher percentage. We used to sell a lot more milk, and now we switch. We sell over 60% of dark chocolates.
Dark chocolate uses more cocoa. Cocoa is more expensive, so those fancy chocolates cost a lot more. Now, if only diamonds will do for your Valentine, you'd better be prepared to pay, says IBISWorld's Hester Jun.
10% of proposals take place on Valentine's Day, which is interesting.
Jun says more people are getting married this year. That's partly because of gay marriage and partly because of an improving economy.
So we're going to see a growth in demand for jewelry this year and also higher prices.
All told, the National Retail Federation expects the average person will spend $133 this Valentine's Day. That's up from $130 last year. And unjustly enough, singles will spend more, about $30 more than their married counterparts. And there's also a gender divide in Valentine's spending, according to chocolatier Jacques Torres.
Women usually are organized. They will go on the website, look at the flavor of the chocolate, and they will come with a couple days before and shop. Men come the last 2 hours of the day. They rush because they double park. They have a price in mind. They don't really know what they buy. I want $20. I want $50 worth of chocolate. When they pass $100, I know they are in trouble.
That's the thing. You can opt not to spend any money at all on Valentine's Day. But that could end up costing you a lot more. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Coming up, theater in the back of a New York City taxi cab.
I want people to fall through the looking glass, I guess. It's a sort of waking dream.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 126 points today, 0.75%, closed at 16,154. The NASDAQ climbed 3 points, less than 0.1%. finished at 42.44. The S&P 500 added 8 points, 0.4%, 1838. A lot of eights there for that index. For the week, the Dow regained 2.25%. The NASDAQ climbed 2.8%. The S&P 500 recovered 2.25%. Weight Watchers has maybe had its day, huh? Fewer people attending meetings. Revenue is barely half what it was a year ago. Yes, Weight Watchers is one of the day's biggest losers, down 27% today. On this day of heartfelt sentiments, bacon producer Tyson Foods gained 0.2%. Hormel Foods packed on 0.8%. Makers of heart stents were also positive. Boston Scientific up 2%. Medtronic, 0.5% gain. Me, I love my job. You're listening to Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Monday. We're off to a good start with a holiday. Light some birthday candles for the nation's first president, George Washington. Or visit Mount Vernon, his home and burial site, where admission is free for the day. Day traders will need to find something to do as U.S. markets will be closed. And it's International Flirting Week. Pull out that banaca. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. This has been a pretty big week, mergers and acquisitions-wise. Comcast, Time Warner Cable was the biggie, of course. Joseph A. Bank buying Eddie Bauer. That's from late last night, early this morning. And then this one, a $900 million deal between two companies you may never have heard of. A Japanese e-commerce conglomerate called Rakuten is buying a messaging app called Viber. There are a bunch of apps that give you free texting and sometimes even voice calls. WhatsApp is one, Line is another. But with all of them fighting for space on my phone and fighting with regular texting and Skype as well, why do you suppose is this one worth 900 million simoleons? Marketplace's Dan Weissman has that story.
Apps like Viber are huge in countries like China, where one called WeChat dominates. Julie Ask from Forrester Research explains why. They're awesome.
I would say to anyone, if they want to know what this is all about or what the craze is all about, go download something like WeChat, get four of your five of your friends to do it, and play with it for a while. You'll get totally hooked. The feature set is so much richer than standard messaging on a mobile phone. There's so much more you can do with it.
Sending videos, pictures, cute little stickers, anything you can imagine to anyone you want, most of it for free, basically replaces your voice plan, your texting plan, and half of Facebook, and e-commerce sites too. With apps built on top of WeChat in China, you can use it to order dinner or a taxi.
These apps, they're not apps. They're platforms.
Adib Gabriel with the IT consulting firm Gartner says it makes sense for a retailer to want in on that business.
Retailers want to understand their customers better. And part of understanding it better is to get them talking.
In other words, what if Amazon knew you as well as Facebook does? Viber has 300 million users, so that's a big head start. Here's Charlene Lee from Altimeter. She thinks Rakuten just picked up a major asset.
They instantly bought access to 300 million people.
That's not as many as Facebook, but it's growing fast, and Facebook couldn't be purchased for $900 million. In Chicago, I'm Dan Weissman for Marketplace.
The complete second season of House of Cards is now officially upon us. The hit series from Netflix went live at the stroke of midnight last night, Pacific time. And besides the actual plotline of that show, the buzz about it has been all about how Netflix is transforming itself from a rental service to an internet television producer. Marketplace's Queen of Kim was in the Netflix control room last night up near San Francisco as the show went live online.
Are we ready? 1 minute.
The new world of internet TV is really geeky. I'm in the Netflix war room. It's a conference room with a big table in the middle. And as we approach midnight, a bunch of engineers are staring at their laptops.
3, 2, 1, Houston.
Episodes are up. Maxine, what do you have on iPad?
We have play starts in Europe.
The number one show on Netflix right now is House of Cards Season 2.
Yeah, all right.
Jeremy Enberg is Netflix reliability architect.
We've probably got, sitting around the room, an Xbox, a PlayStation, a Nintendo, Apple devices, Android devices, a couple of different TVs from our partner manufacturers.
The engineers can tell in real time how many people are streaming the show on these devices and where they are. Joris Evers is Netflix spokesman. He says that's just a fraction of the data they gather.
We monitor what you watch, how often you watch things. Does a movie have a happy ending? What is the level of romance? What's the level of violence? Is it a cerebral kind of movie or is it light and funny?
Evers says Netflix uses this data when it decides which original programs to buy.
House of Cards was obviously a big bet for Netflix, but it was a calculated bet because we knew Netflix members like political dramas. We knew that Netflix members like serialized dramas, that they are fans of Kevin Spacey, that they like David Fincher.
Netflix's move into original programming is all about taking viewers from other media companies, especially HBO. Brad Adgate is an analyst at Horizon Media. He says Netflix has more online subscribers than HBO, but when it comes to making money, Netflix is David to HBO's Goliath. But Adgate says Netflix does have its slingshot.
I think right now Netflix does have a competitive advantage over HBO because of the analytics.
Adgate says networks like HBO still rely in large part on Nielsen data. But Netflix is getting data that's more textured, granular, and valuable when it comes to determining audience preferences.
And I think that that's the way television and streaming video is headed. But I think right now streaming video is in the lead.
Adgate says it's just a matter of time before HBO and the other premium channels catch up. From the Netflix War Room, I'm Queenie Kim for Marketplace.
Here's something new-ish from the New York theater scene. Immersive theater is what it's called. The idea being to take the play out of the theater, to blur the lines between the audience and the actors. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour visited what may well be the ultimate immersive theater experience.
You wait for this show to start in the foyer of the theater, which in this case means I'm standing in an ATM vestibule in Manhattan.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to need you to sign this release form before you get in the cab.
That is Zane Roberts, and yes, he said cab. This play is called Take Me Home, and it takes place in a taxi. There's only room for three passenger/audience members, and there are three of us, so it's a sold-out show. Car pulls up, we clamber in.
Hello. Okay, listen up. Cab rules. I'm a respectable cab driver, so if you get out of control, I will put on NPR and make you listen to classical music.
As we drive around town, a foggy sort of narrative, which I won't spoil, unfolds around the cab driver with the help of audiovisual recordings.
Oh, it's a mess. It's a disaster.
And very quickly, things get weird. People and buildings outside the cab start to match up with what's going on inside. Or at least you think they are. You start staring at random people trying to figure out if they're in the play or not.
Yo, you want to get run over? I can facilitate that.
What is actually happening is there are staged actors around the ride route performing in a highly choreographed way. But you don't know who is an actor and who isn't. The effect is that the city, the whole city, becomes one giant stage, and reality just starts to melt.
It was definitely unlike any cab ride I've ever taken.
Elena Cohen was the second third of our backseat audience.
It's only about that, like, view out the window and just, like, it's like being in a movie almost or something.
That is exactly what playwright Allie Collier intended.
I want people to fall through the looking glass, I guess. It's a sort of waking dream.
But this is more than a vision. It's a response to what avant-garde theater consumers have demanded. Immersive and unique experiences, like the recent hit Sleep No More, which allows audience members to wander around and mingle with actors during the performance. Other plays have been held in hospitals or Turkish baths. Take Me Home might be the most intimate of them all. There are four times more cast members than audience members, which brings up one glaring question.
How can you possibly pay for it with three audience members at a time?
Yes, that has been the biggest question on my mind.
Lauren Rayner is Take Me Home's producer. The tickets have ranged from $25 to $50, and the performance is 45 minutes long.
We wrote grants. We approached individual donors.
Everyone had to volunteer a lot of unpaid hours. Rayner thinks this experiment could scale up profitably with more cabs and more actors.
If the right investor wanted to come on board for this
what I would call a romantic investment, then yes, there would be something fruitful. Although I don't think it's a Broadway show, you know, where you can have 500 seats and you're expecting millions in returns. That wouldn't be it. This would be a philanthropic endeavor.
But with no new investors slash donors on the horizon, they considered raising prices. And with a wait list of 150 people, they could have. But pricier tickets would have priced out a lot of people, which playwright Allie Collier, who herself works a day job as an executive assistant, is loath to do.
I want people to be able to see it. Theater, this might come as a surprise to you, is not a huge money-making exercise unless you're working on Broadway. There has to be a deep and abiding love for the theater and for art and for what you do in order to be able to keep doing it.
So she and the actors do what so many artists do. They do without. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, which comes to us via the Wall Street Journal, the Olympics and Under Armour, the athletic clothing company. Under Armour shares were off almost 2.5% today. That after the Journal reported that, quote, people familiar with the U.S. speed skating team were blaming Under Armour suits for American skaters' poor performance. It is not, I imagine, what one would call an ideal product placement, huh? All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from 8 p.m. this Friday. Today, the Dow up 126 points, 0.75%. The NASDAQ climbed 3 points, less than 0.1%. The S&P 500 added 8 points, 0.4%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace was developed by J.J. Yor. It is produced by Sitar Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you Monday, everybody. Have a good weekend. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.